Hey, what's up? I'm so excited to introduce you to my guest today, but before I do, I have one request. If you are here looking to become a better athlete or to help others become a better athlete, hit that subscribe button so you don't miss a future episode. I'm blown away each week by the value that my guests have been dropping, and trust me, there are some episodes you are not going to want to miss that are coming up. Including this one. I interview Max Rook, a native of England who grew up playing for professional team Reading Football Club. That's soccer if you're in America here, before moving to the US to play collegiate soccer for the D1 Mercer University. During this time, he won four conference championships, was Atlantic Sun Conference Player of the Year and All-American, and is currently the only male soccer player in school history at Mercer to have his jersey retired. Yes, I said that his jersey is retired. Max also has the distinguished honor of being a member of the Great Britain national soccer team and has competed at two world championships. He now coaches as associate head women's soccer coach at Pepperdine University in California. And since starting there in 2014, he's been a part of two West Coast Conference championships, one NCAA Sweet 16 appearances, as well as four tournament appearances and two NCAA Regional Staff of the Year awards. With a life dedicated to performance, Max has a unique perspective on recovery that I am excited to share with you. We chat about his career both as an athlete and now a coach, and how that has shaped his view on recovery, what role emotion plays in recovery, and the number one roadblock athletes have for getting to the next level of performance. This is good stuff, so let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Max, it's great to have you on the show. I'm so excited to get into our conversation here today.
I appreciate you having me, Jay. So I'm excited to be here too.
Sweet. So, I want to start. Obviously, we had an intro on you, so the listener knows a little bit about you. But if not mistaken, you started your soccer career pretty early in life. What age were you started at?
I appreciate the opportunity to kind of go down memory lane, Jay. You know what I'm saying? Like sometimes we don't get these opportunities. So the fact that we can take a trip down memory lane. But yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of people that have careers in the sports world, I think you can date it back to really early ages. So I remember as young as, goodness me, I think I was playing my first team when I was, I was 5 or 6 years old and stuff like that. And I remember playing, my mom, God rest her soul, she, I think one of my first ever matches I went to play, like we had to get like the kit the day before the game and the shorts didn't fit and she had like the safety pin trying to put everything together, you know? So, I mean, it was super, super young. And I think that ultimately, just like whether it's soccer or whether it's, running or like whatever sport, whatever passion, I think we get that from childhood, right? And it develops within us, and there's a real sense of, if you love what you do, then you're willing to continue it on. So for me, I really just as soon as I touched a soccer ball, it was like that's for me, and that's then turned into a career of playing, which has now turned into a career of coaching, and I'm so thankful that I was able to do the things that I've done. And it really leads back to such an early age. So,
So were your parents then soccer players as well, or how did you get introduced to it?
No, not really. So I can tell you exactly how it happened. My mom and dad would tell me this. I don't remember this, but I remember being told.
Okay.
And it was basically, I was at like primary school in England. So again, whatever age that was, and we used to play at break, you know, you'd have like lunchtime or you'd have like small breaks in the day. Yeah. And we would, you know, all the boys, you know, would go out and we'd kick around on the playground and we'd play soccer. And there was this boy that was a few years older than me. And he's like, hey, he's like, you know, I play for this team, you know, like you should come and play for our team. And I'm like, all right, that sounds like fun. You know, I had no idea what it was. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like fun. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm 6 or 7 at the time and he's 9 or something like that. Like yeah. He's older. And I remember going home and I'm like, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm going to practice tonight for this team. And my mom's like, no, you're not. Like, how are we going to get? I'm like, I'm going to practice for this team. And so she's like, well, where is it? When is it? Who's going to be? I'm like, I don't know, but I know I'm going to practice. And so, anyway, I convinced my parents to take me to this practice that they had no idea. And it literally, like, I got home from school and it was a quick turnaround to get there. And then I think 2 days later was the first game. And so the coach told my parents, like, hey, your son, like, he should probably be on this team. So do you, you know, can he play on Saturday? You know? And sure enough, that takes you back to like the safety pin and the short story. So that was like, it was a whole thing where it was maybe one of the first points in my life where I think my parents, like, they saw like a hunger or something. You know, you know what it is, Jace, right? You get that little look in your eye that says, yeah, like, you know, there's something about it. And I think that they said that was, I came home from school with this look that I hadn't had before that just said, you know, like, I'm doing this thing. And
yeah,
and that was it. So they never played before. They weren't really, neither of them were really athletes and stuff. So
interesting.
Yeah. Picked it up on the playground.
Sweet. So how are they like supportive then of that? Did they have to learn the sport then and kind of understand, yeah, what was going on, or did they stay their distance from it?
Oh no, I had such loving parents. And I think that one of the reasons why I was able to stay within the game, like, you know, still, mm-hmm, still being involved in the game even to today, is because of my parents. Mm. And they never pushed it on me. They supported me. They picked me up when I got knocked down, you know, and they shared my trials and my tribulations and my highs and my lows, and they, mm-hmm, were always there for me. And again, they never pushed me. They never made it more than it needed to be. And I think, sure, that I'm really thankful for, because I do see, as I'm sure we could share this, like I do see in the game, especially in the youth sports, being involved, yeah, in youth sports, that is not always the case. Mm-hmm. And you look at some of the longevity of careers, you know, not even at the highest levels, but just in general, like, and sometimes it can be at the detriment of, you know, if parents are too involved or if they're too pressurized, it can be at the detriment of the player and, you know, quitting early or giving up and stuff like that. Yeah, so I'm very thankful that was never the case with my parents. So yeah.
That's
yeah.
cool. So as you get older, you know, in the high school age, that's when were you in a boarding school at that point playing, or how did that work?
No, so basically the simple way of saying it is, so in England, the progression to kind of the professional level is pretty streamlined. And so I never played high school, never played, like, really got to an age when I was by about 14, I was 12, 13, something like that. I wasn't really playing any type of like club sports or anything like that. Like, I was playing for Reading Football Club and I was, you know, I was full tilt, you know, full steam ahead. Sure. And so it was in their system. And so you're playing against other professional, you know, teams, youth systems and stuff like that. And it's a very structured, very rigid. I was fortunate that the club that I got picked up by, and that they had a couple of other options, but the one that I stepped by staying with Reading, it was the local team. So there were other players my age that were in boarding schools, but I didn't have to because the club was in my town. Like, I'm from Reading. Cool. And so I didn't need to do that. Yeah. But had I chosen a different option, then, like you said, I probably would have been in a boarding school, and you know, that's kind of how they do it over there. So, but sure. But I didn't have to do that because of locationally, like I say, where I lived, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of nice. Gives you the home field advantage every time.
Absolutely.
So, and now in England, like, soccer is a way bigger sport than it is here in the United States. Yep. You know, with that comes a lot of social pressure, cultural pressures, and that. Did you feel that at that age?
I think that's a great question, Jason. I think there's an unwritten rule, if you will, like, that everybody, if you're playing soccer and you're in England, like, everybody wants to be a professional. You know, everybody everybody has a vision. It's like, what do you want to do? I want to play for the national team. I want to play for, you know, I want to make lots of money. I want to be on TV. Like there's something about, like, it's almost like it's an unwritten, everybody is like heading towards the same, same path, if you will. And so with that, I think there are some pressures, whether that's placed on you subconsciously or consciously, I think that there are some pressures that come along with that. And so absolutely. You know, some of the coaching there was pretty stern, pretty tough, because they're trying to prepare you for a life in an industry and environment that's pretty cutthroat, right? And so how to prepare you for that is you kind of get subjected to some things at an earlier age than maybe you would if you were in a different environment, right? Or if you had a different type of path. And so,
kinds of things?
I think the coaching itself. There's a developmental process, right? Sure. You're trying to develop you as players, but mentally, I think also, you know, and you know what I do in terms of the mental side of it, but so physically they're trying to develop you in such a way to prepare you for the rigors of playing at the highest level. Yeah. But mentally at that level, you have to be able to deal with a lot, right? And so I think that part of their system of trying to figure out who is capable of making it to the next level, part of it is physical. Part of it is technical, part of it is tactical, but part of it is, do you have the mental strength and capability to handle all of the pressure that comes with playing at that level? And they're looking at that, not when you get to when you already get in that environment, they're looking at like 14, 15, like, do you have the mental capacity right now? You know, because a lot of players, and this, I don't know, digress a little bit, I don't get too far off, but you know, in England, you see a lot of players that make their first team debut in front of 50,000 people at 17 years old, you know, or 18. It's not like they're 20 something, you know, they're not full grown men. These are still kids. They're 17 years old and, you know, and you're making your first team debut. So to be able to perform at that level that young, then the developmental process, that's way early, if that makes sense, right? So you're subjected to certain things to be ready at 17, then at 14, they're 15, at 16, they're doing things and training you in such a way where you're ready at 17 versus trying to be ready at 24 or 25. It's just a different timeline, if you will.
So that's really interesting. I want to get into more of your career before we talk about your coaching. So I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too far, but I would imagine that experience has shaped kind of your coaching now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. 100%. It taught me who I wanted to be and who I didn't want to be. And maybe more so, it kind of taught me who I didn't want to be, right? And how I didn't want to coach. And knowing what I went through as a player, it reflecting on that, I'm like, would I want my players that I coach now to have the same experience? And if not, how can I change my coaching style and my philosophy to meet that of what I'm trying, what I'm the path that I want my players on? So, Exactly. And again, by the way, it's not to say that I had a negative experience, but it's just, it's really interesting. So for sure, absolutely. Like I say, it definitely shaped me into who I am today. It shaped me into the coach I am, the person I am. And I'm eternally grateful for it too. Yeah. I think that that's the biggest thing in all of this is that, if you can look at every experience as a blessing, you know, as an opportunity to grow and to get better, not worse, right? And to help you, not hurt you. Then I look at everything that happened as an absolute blessing. You know?
Yeah,
everything's a positive.
Cool. So your transition from Reading to United States here. First of all, what caused that transition?
So basically, just didn't get my contract renewed, and at an early age. You know, so I was a young player in the Reading system and stuff like that. And so without going into great detail, but basically when I got told, you know, hey, you're not tall enough, right? You're not tall enough. You're not strong enough, whatever it's going to be, whatever the reasons were, it's like, then like a lot of players, you're like, what do I do? Do I find another club? Do I continue to try on? Do I, you know, bounce from club to club trying to make it work? Do I drop down a few leagues and see if I can then, you know, find a team and then work my way back up? And at that time, and this is kind of like, I think this is a God thing, you know, it's like, so at that time, there was this new thing that was emerging, and it was soccer. It was soccer. It was the opportunity to come out to America, and I had no idea. I knew nobody that was out here. And but the Professional Football Association, who you become a member of, they were putting these trials on, basically these trials. And there was this new thing that said, anybody that's out of contract, there's this opportunity to go to these trials and to be looked at by these American colleges for the potential to have a career in America. So at that time, I'm like, well, do I do what everybody else has always done? Or do I try, you know, the path, you know, least taken, if you will, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, you know what, we'll give it a try, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So I went out there, did this trial, and sure enough, you know, I got the opportunity to come out to America. There was a coach who said, hey, you know, look, I think we'd like to have you. Would you like to come out? And so long story short is I accepted the opportunity to come out. And at that time, I knew nothing about America. I knew nothing about college soccer. I knew, you know, I between California and Georgia or East Coast, West Coast, I had no idea.
Yeah.
All I knew is that I came over with a suitcase and a dream. And I knew that once I stepped on the plane, life would never be the same again, you know? And, and it was kind of that monumental moment. I think there's a few moments in our lives. I think there's a lot of little things that impact our lives every single day. But I also think that there's some monumental moments where the decision you make will shape your path forever. And that was one of those moments. Yeah. All I knew is that when I stepped on the plane, that life would never be the same again. And I didn't exactly know how it was going to work out. But looking back now, I'm so grateful and so blessed that I did decide to step on the plane and came over to Macon, Georgia. So it was great.
You seem to have a bold pattern of betting on yourself from being, you know, a 5-6 year old and telling your parents, I'm going to practice to then being 19 and like, going to a country I've never been. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I know me and I know what I want. So that's cool. With that type of personality, a lot of athletes that are, you know, very successful have, but it can also be a detriment when somebody tells them they're not good enough. They're not, you know. Mm-hmm. So what was that like when Redding essentially said, you know, hey, Max, you're not good enough for us?
Yeah. Yeah. It was crushing. It was crushing for sure. It was crushing for sure. When you have a dream and a vision of how you believe, you know, your path to be, then it was absolutely crushing, and it shook me to my knees, and it at a pivotal time in my life. It was it was all I knew. So absolutely, it was very tough to deal with, and there was a lot of stresses and there was a lot of dark moments. But I also think that, and this, I'm not speaking about myself now, but working with a lot of high performers and working with a lot of athletes that play at really high levels and teams, that having a short memory is really important, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you talk about even just like a bad loss, or like in your case, you know, you don't meet your times for a run or something like that, like you can let it either, like I said, help you or hurt you, make you better or worse, you know, and so you have two options. I mean, it is that simple, right? You're like, sometimes we make it more than what it is. You have two choices of how you're going to take it. And so what I've learned over time is that the best, if you will, have this really short memory span where they learn from those moments and they put a cap on it. You know, it's like, I go to bed, I wake up the next day. All right, we're moving on. I'm going to learn from it and I'm going to choose. They don't dwell on it. Like if you dwell on something, then it's going to affect the next thing and the next thing. And then your trajectory starts to change. So I think that, you know, avoiding failures and avoiding mistakes and avoiding adversity, that's impossible, right? It's not a part of any person that has achieved great things. But what you do with those things and how long you focus on those things is really important. And I think that's what I've learned along the way. And so in that case, you know, there was a few days where it really hurt me, but then it quickly became, okay, well, what's the next step? You know, what's the next step? And that's for me when the next step was a bold one. It was like, yeah, I'm going to do something that nobody's ever done before, you know, and let's do it and make it happen. So
your parents, were they on board with that, or did you have to convince them?
They were always supportive. I think I go back to what I said, like before, that they've always supported me. I think it was tough for them to see somebody. My whole family lives in England. Like I was the, like everybody lives in England. Everybody lives within a short radius. Yeah. My whole family lives within a couple of miles of each other. So to be the only person to just decide up and leave, it was tough for them. And there were some moments where they didn't necessarily understand, like, why would you want to leave the family? I'm like, well, I'm not really leaving the family. I'm just going to a little bit further away. But there was something inside, I think, that's what I'm getting at. I think it's inside my heart, there was something speaking to me, and it's God speaking to me saying, like, if you want to do great things, like, this is the journey you have to take. And at that time, it meant leaving the family. And I don't think they understood at the time, even though they did support me, which again, I'm very thankful for. So cool. I appreciate you asking these questions, by the way. Like I say, this is the stuff I hadn't talked about for a while. So this is great. Appreciate it.
Well, it makes you, it like your upbringing shapes who you are, your views on life. And not only that, I mean, there's going to be somebody listening to this that's thinking about taking that bold move, that's thinking that, taking that step, and hearing your story is going to encourage them in some way. So people are very relatable, Max, so.
Yeah. I appreciate it.
Now, when you got to the U.S., got to a D1 athletics and stuff, you put on a pretty good career, sounds like. It's a pretty big deal to have your jersey, retired from a school. So walk us through kind of how that went. What was the switch of in there that kind of got you to the next level? And then what was the achievements that got your jersey retired?
I always try and talk about anything like this when that question comes up. I want to make sure we start with saying like that is a reflection of our team. Like, we had a really great team, any type of individual award is, in my eyes, is a reflection of how great our team was. So to have my jersey retired is almost like our jersey was retired. Like, our team did that. Like, we had some really, really cool things that our team did. But yeah, we got there, and there was a few players that came in my class, and we were able to really just change the culture a little bit. I think we walked into what was a pretty solid culture, but there was some things where we got there and we're like, hey, I think we can push the envelope here, right? We can push the boundary of what's possible. And so within 1 year, we went from being like a decent team, like not a bad team. We were decent. We were always decent.
Yeah.
But we went from being decent and immediately it's not me. This is a group of people.
Yeah.
That decided, hey, like, if we're going to do it, let's do it right. And that quickly turned into a championship. And then, you've got the regular season and then the conference tournament. So it was like, we won the regular season 1 year, but we didn't win the conference championship. The next year we won the conference championship and then the conference tournament, went to the NCAA. So we're like back-to-back champions. Then in our senior year, we did the same thing. So it's like, we didn't know any better, if you will, we didn't know any better. We're like, so let's just go for broke. Right.
Yeah.
It seemed to be a theme, right? That go for broke. So let's go for it. Like, let's not set a bar on ourselves. And so in 3 years, we kind of changed the course of the program. And since then, the program has continued to do amazing things. And so it was really great. And obviously being disciplined. And I know that you're a big proponent of the recovery and some of these different things. And so when you talk about like some of the things that we did, it wasn't even just on the field, but it was like the way we prepared for games. It was what we did after games. It was changing the culture of like how much sleep we got, And again, what college life's like, right? And it's like, well, there's a party over here and there's a party over here. It's like, but being able to say no, being able to say no to things is a powerful thing, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's 100%. Easy to say yes, 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 and get drawn in. But to have the intent and the capacity to say no to something, you have to know why you want to say no to it. It's so easy to say yes, but like, to be able to say no, you've got to say no because you're saying yes to something else, and to know why that thing is greater and is more important to you. That's a culture thing. Right. And so, so I think we're able to change like the process of how, what things meant to us, how we prepare for things like post game, like doing the little things, making sure that we treat our bodies right. So, and all those things collectively came out on the field. And I put a lot of things down to that. So I think it started with a cultural shift, a mindset shift, which turned into like just a lot of the little things that I know you're a big proponent of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It starts with what happens in between training and in between competition. I tell college students all the time, the difference between somebody succeeding in college and somebody, you know, never getting better than high school is their lifestyle. You know, how much sleep are they getting? What are they choosing to put in their body and all that kind of stuff. And if you, I mean, you nail that part of it, then college athletics becomes really fun.
So true.
So after college, then you got to play a little bit with Great Britain. How was that for you? Was that everything you dreamed it would be? Or
You know, I think go back to the little boy inside you, right? Like it's all coming the full circle, Jace. We're doing the full circle. It's like I always had a dream and a goal, you know, play professionally. And one of my other goals was to represent my country. And, you know, obviously when you get told no at the professional level, like, then you're like, well, how am I going to make that happen? And I really didn't know how it was going to happen, but you just continue to push forward and do things. So then from playing at Mercer, they had this thing called the World University Games and the World Championships. And so I was playing and somebody like reached out to me and said, hey, like, are you aware that you're eligible for this? And you are, and you know, you can be a part of this. Like the coach reached out to me. I said, well, sure. When we talk about that team, the World Championship team, a good portion of the team were players from England playing in England and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But as I told you, like this emergence of the American side and players, good players that were going out to the States, it's like they would be remiss if they didn't try and include some of those players because, you know, you're trying to put the best team together. And so, so then at times when there was no season, they would invite players like myself and other players that were in America to come back and train with the national team setup to see, you know, would this be a good fit? And so as you're preparing for the championships that are every couple of years, I know the Olympics are every 4 years, but these championships are every 2 years. So in that 2 year process, I got to be a part of that and go back. And so finally when the championships rolled around, I was selected to be in the squad and I made it to the squad. So we played in Beijing. It was 2001 was in Beijing. So we got to be with the team for like a month. We went to like Japan for like a holding camp and did all that. Yeah, and then we got to go to Beijing. And then 2 years later, it was in Korea. It was in Seoul, Korea.
Yeah.
And I was in America and the coach was the same. And so the same process. And he's like, look, you know, just letting you know that, you know, I want you to be a part of that in 2 years, if you can stay fit, right? Lifestyle, like you're saying, Chase, right? Yeah. Like you got to keep yourself because now I'm outside of college, but it's like, so the opportunities to play, still trying to find a way to stay fit, to stay relevant and stuff like that. So the lifestyle, you brought up a great point. So I think that at that point, lifestyle was the most important thing to be able to stay at the level. So when I was invited back, I could step in back into that environment and perform at that level, you know? And so lifestyle was massive for me, not necessarily the first time, but the second time around, because my opportunities to play, like on the back end, coming, graduating from Mercer and so on and so forth, my opportunities to play, I wouldn't say they were limited, but it wasn't as much. It wasn't like I wasn't training every single day with the team. So anyways, my point being is that lifestyle became such a massive piece that allowed me to then have that second experience, which was phenomenal, you know? So to get to that twice and then to almost, I'll end it like this, to check off that dream and say, hey, you know, even though it wasn't necessarily with the full national team, but to play in the World Championships with Great Britain, you know, was something I'll never forget, you know? I'll never forget that. And then to be able to give that jersey that I wore and give it to my dad to honor him and say thank you for, you know, always believing in me was a special moment too, you know? So it's great.
Awesome. That's so cool. So, yeah, obviously, and you kind of touched on this lifestyle, but I want to go more into detail with what some of your habits were in college and when you're on, you know, Great Britain's team. How did you treat recovery from sleep, nutrition, you know, just other habits? How did you treat recovery?
Well, I didn't know at the beginning, just like now being a coach, it's like you're trying to teach, you know, teach or coach your players.
Yeah.
those habits. Now, so I'm on the other side of it. So as a player, like, you know, somebody had to tell me, look, you know, if you want to go to the next level, like, you got to do this, right? And he's like, you know, you need to jump in that ice bath over there. I'm like, why would I want to jump in the ice bath? That's too cold. He's like, well, if you want to get to the next level, you need to get in the ice bath. I'm like, you know, and it wasn't until somebody explained to me why I needed to go into the ice bath after a match, you know? And now, you know, there's so many different tools like now, you know, in terms of what the post game is for some of our players that I coach now, it's way different how it was for me, you know.
Sure.
You know, kind of old school. There's a tub over there, and it's full of ice, go jump in it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but like things like ice baths, but the rehab, right? So the rehab and taking care of like all of the little knocks, like, so the little strains and the pulls, and not necessarily major injuries that keep you out, but just sticking to the process of getting the rehab and attention and rolling out and stretching. And like you said before, like the intentionality with getting an early night's sleep, like every hour before 12 o'clock is like two, right? And I've heard that before, like every hour before that you sleep before 12 is worth like 2 hours on the back end or something like that. So it's like, so just like, you know, going to bed earlier, right? Stuff like that. So eating, you know, like just, you know, it's just a cookie or it's just this, it's just that, but like eating clean and just being very, very,
what does eating clean mean to you? Cause I know that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, I just think, a lot of fresh foods, right? A lot of greens and, you know, at the time for us, like, you know, like a lot of pasta and just like carbs and stuff like that. But I mean, I can tell you a story. This is kind of, I think I could put it like this.
Yeah,
so I remember the world championships, we was like, I don't know if it was Great Britain was or whatever, but by Nutrigrain was like, we were sponsored by like Nutrigrain or something like that. And so there, those Nutrigrain bars, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so they would talk to us about simple carbs and complex carbs, right? You know, and the complex carbs being like, you know, the pastas and the rices and all that sort of stuff. But then there's those simple carbs that which now we know, like, you know, chocolate milk and stuff like that, or things like after a game, you got to get that protein, but you also got to get that sugar and those electrolytes and those carbs into your body within 30 minutes of when you're done to be able to kind of, you know, help with that recovery process. And so again, I'm going way back, like now this is like, it's a given, but way back then it was kind of new. And so they're like, hey, you need to eat within 30 minutes after you play. And I'm like, well, I don't feel like eating, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
And they're like, well, you need to eat and you need to eat like one, I forget what the formula was they said, but like 1 gram of like simple carbs for every kilogram of body weight, you know? And so they had it weighed out. And so they kind of had it to where they knew our body weights. And so we would show back in the locker room, we'd go play this game, we'd go play against China or Portugal or wherever it's going to be. And we'd come back in the locker room. And then they would be sat on our table, would be the exact amount of, you know, carbs that we would need. And it might be like two Nutrigrain bars and a banana or something like that. And anyways, my long story short, Jason, say this, after a month of eating 2 or 3 or 4 Nutrigrain bars every single day, like, it doesn't matter how many flavors you try and change it up, like, it got to a point, like, if I see a Nutrigrain bar now, like, I have to turn away, like, I have to, like, I can't look at one, I can't eat one, because I'm like, I'm scarred from the amount of Nutrigrain bars I had when I was at the World Championships. It was like frighteningly bad how many I had. But, you know, at the time, and so I go back to it, like, the discipline is like, you know, well, I don't want it. And they're like, but if you want to play well the next game, you need to do it. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So from a mindset standpoint, it didn't make sense to me how many things I was consuming at the time or what I was consuming. But but when your why, when you connect it to a deeper sense of, okay, well, this is going to help me get from here to here, then I'm way more willing to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And now I'm not in that place. I'm like, that was silly. Like, you know, that was, I mean, like, how many, you know, Nutrigrain bars I was eating, you know? I'm like, but at the time it made sense because it helped us
get
to the level that we need to. So anyways, so that's my point is when I go down the aisle shopping now, I avoid the Nutrigrain aisle at all costs.
It's funny. So, I have a similar story with Pop-Tarts, which they're not as healthy, but when I was really young, my family was going down to the Grand Canyon for a vacation. We were training to do we were going to see if we could get down to the Colorado River and back in one day, which we ended up not not doing, but we're doing these long hikes around our house. And we did this one, like 9 or 10 mile hike, and all we took was Pop Tarts with us.
That's it.
I never wanted to see another Pop Tart in my life.
It's ingrained, right? It's ingrained in your memory. Like, that's it. It's God for life. So it's okay.
So now, you know, you've been an athlete. Obviously, the industry has kind of evolved with the recovery tool and that kind of stuff. So what are some things that you teach or coach your athletes to make sure that they're doing on a daily basis specific for recovery?
Yeah. I will say this, that we're very blessed, the place that we're at, that we have somebody who takes care of that for us. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, sure, we've come so far that I think, you know, a few years ago, I say a few, however you create that too, but there was a time where the coach was everything, right? The coach was the trainer, and the coach was the strength and conditioning coach. And they did the treatment, and then they wrapped the ankles, and, you know, and you did a bit of everything. And now we've come to a place where it's so specialized that we have people on staff that is their that is the only thing they think about every single day is the pre and post game, you know, and the recovery of our players and the treatment of our players. So it's really, you know, I'm really grateful that we have surround ourselves, our team, with professionals that mm-hmm. is what they do. But, you know, but again, I mean, we practice at 7:30 and, you know, 6 a.m. they're in on the treatment tables, and they're getting their stim, and they're getting all their heat pads, and they're getting, you know, and they're doing all of the things that they need to do. And after every practice, they're rolling out and they're doing the foam rollers and they're, you know, and I think for me, one of the things that I've noticed is like the progression and the evolution of how you stretch, right? And what used to be like a lot of static stretching is now a lot of the mechanics is different, right? And it's a lot of active stretch, a lot of movement patterns and stuff like that, activation, right? Which wasn't the way back then, right? And post-game with bands, right? And like I say, with rollers. And it's just a different approach. And so I know our players, they take that very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. Because as I said before, like, you know, you wake up the next day and you'll feel, did, you know, even if you did the foam roller, even if you did the bands, but if you didn't do them with intentionality, you can feel it the next day. And so we make sure that our players are dialed in with that. And I forget the name, but I'm thinking about those, the compression, the things that you put, that you sit in
Normtech.
Yeah, that's it. Yep, that's it. The Normtech. Our girls love the Normtech. They such fans of the Normtech because it does similar to like maybe some of like the ice baths and all this things, but it's just a lot less painful, if you will. But our girls love the Normtech, you know, they swear by that for sure.
Yeah. So I interviewed Sonia Wick, who's an Ironman athlete and adventure racer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She swears by the Normtech boots too.
Our girls love them. Love them. They love them. I see them all the time. They're always in them. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah, we had a couple at our school, and it was always a pleasure to go down and to the recovery room and put on the boots and listen to some music and fall asleep.
Exactly. That's it. Awesome.
Yeah. So how do you think mindset, especially when it comes to like fear, anxiety for a competition, or after a competition, like fear and anxiety of how you played or you know, negative emotions, how does that affect recovery in your opinion?
It's a great question. I think this is what, let me know if this is the way you kind of wished with the question you were asking me, but my sense is this, is that when you let emotion get into the equation. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like when disappointment sets in, or like you say, or like if fear sets in, or if, right, or if, like I say, anger sets in after a match or something like that, emotionally, what it does is it changes our approach. Right. Mm. And I think that ultimately the very best have a way of taking emotion, setting it aside, and knowing that regardless of result, regardless of performance, there is a specific and strategic way that I need to prepare and recover in every single match.
Sure.
Does that make sense? And so if you're like mad after a game, you might not recover and do the things that you need to do to be prepared, because you're still mentally sitting on all of those mistakes. And let's just put it this way too. Sometimes if you get too cocky, if you like, you win, like, oh yeah, we won. And so the emotionally you go into a place, well, maybe I don't need to recover. And so you move out of the discipline of knowing that strategically what got you to where you are needs to be replicated. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when you can set those emotional highs and lows and say, regardless of that, there is a very specific way that I need to prepare for every match. And there is a very specific way that I need to recover after every match. And it doesn't matter whether we won, we lost, we won 8-0, we lost 8-0. I was the winner, I was the loser, whether I played well or I didn't play, whether I played a lot or I didn't play a lot.
Yeah.
It shouldn't really matter. What matters is that recovery, like what you're talking about, those are scientific sort of, you know, understandings like of our bodies, that if you do, you know, this and this, then you will get this, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not an emotional thing. That is a science thing, right? Does that make sense? You know, like, yeah, obviously, 100%. Like, you know, science of recovery. And so I think that emotions can sometimes get in the way of our need to want to follow the science, right? And so, but I think the greats have an ability to emotionally stay pretty consistent that allows them to always use preparation and recovery to its maximum. So
yeah,
I don't know if that makes sense or if that was kind of like the answer,
100%. I've seen that play out, you know, even in my own career, where whether it was a really good, you know, race or a really bad race, I cool down, I recover, you know, do my post race a little bit differently based on that sometimes, you know, after like a really good run, then you're like, you know, you take time to celebrate and then you're like, oh crap, I gotta get on the bus. And you don't like really take the time to cool down. The bad race, sometimes there's that tendency to sulk and to like, you're just then unmotivated to do anything that takes effort, and recovery takes effort.
Absolutely.
And stuff. So that brings up a great point. Also, especially like, this is probably more relevant in contact sports, you know, like soccer or football or basketball. You get, you know, little nicks and bruises and from other players, you know, from running around, getting hit with the ball, getting hit by other players. You know, I would imagine that there's afterwards, you could have some bruises that feel a little bit worse than some other times and start to get in your own head about, oh, this could be something bigger than it is. How do you like know when to take something serious or to be like, no, I can work through this?
That is a great question. How do I answer that? That is a really, really great question. That has got me thinking. I want to say that, again, I've used this term a few times already, Jason. Mm-hmm. It's that, not necessarily me, but I know I've experienced this and you might really relate to this, but when you start to surround yourself with really, really high level people doing life at a high level, you start to see patterns, right? And you mentioned the word again about being bold and being courageous. Is I think that players who are at the top of the top, you know, the highest level, they find every reason to not be limited by what's possible. What I mean by that is that a little nick, a niggle or a little injury isn't going to prevent them from playing the next game, you know, or it isn't going to stop them from their pursuit of what they want. Now, do you have to have the right people that can also guide you and give you the right information so you don't overdo it? Absolutely. Yeah. But what I see is there are some people who you can use excuses to prevent them from going to the places that they want to go. Oh, well, I've got this, or I've got this. And then there are certain people that they take the complete opposite approach. And they're like, you know, and it's this, and it's the same injury, or it's the same knock, or it's the same bruise.
Yeah.
But to somebody, it's like, well, I think I should take it easy on this day. And then somebody else is saying, that is not going to be the reason why myself or us as a team are not going to do the thing that we want to do. Yeah. And so I think that the mentality that supports that, it's like, I kind of, all of these conversations, if you notice now, they seem to come back to the why, right? And so mm-hmm. when you talk about the science of recovery and stuff like that, it's like, you know, what is your why? You know, why yeah. do you recover? Why do you, you know, do all of those little things that to a lot of people are like, well, you know, why would you, you know, why do you spend so much time, you know, yeah. doing those things that you need to do? But when it's connected to a why, then it's not work, right? Or it's not, you know, it's not something that you have to do, but you get to do it. I like to say that yeah. to a lot of people. It's like, you know, do you have to do something, or do you get to do it? You know, do you have to prepare for the game, or do you get to prepare for the game? Do I have to do a post recovery, or do I get to do a post recovery? If yeah. you have to do it, it's you approach it very, very differently
100%.
Than if you get to do it, you know? And so again, I kind of coming back to your question is that when you look at some of these strains and this and that and these knocks that could seem like, oh my God, like, yeah, I do feel it. But it's like, do I have to deal with that, or do I get to deal with it? Is it just a part of, is it a part of my process, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just a different, but it's all related to mentality, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a part of a team culture,
yeah.
But there's a deeper sense of meaning that you can associate yeah. to some of these things that you're talking about, like a knock or a bruise or a ache or a pain, and it's mm-hmm. it's association. So yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you kind of described, going back to this interview I did with the Iron Man, Sonia Wick, mm-hmm. episode 4, for anybody out there wants to listen. She had a quote that said, the coach's responsibility is to protect the players from themselves. It's the player's mm-hmm. responsibility to, like you said, just, you know, go and do no matter what.
Like, yeah, it's great.
So I can see the relationship here.
Yeah, it's great wisdom.
All that.
Great wisdom.
So now you as a coach, you focus, you know, and you can tell by the way you're answering a lot of these questions, you focus a lot on mentality of sport.
Yeah.
Like what do you think is the biggest mentality, like, mistake that an athlete has, or the most common thing that somebody needs to get through to take it, like, to the next level?
Yeah. Oh, and that is a massive question. And I think that what I've learned, this wasn't something that I came to early on, whether it be as a player or even as a coach in my early years as a coach. But mm-hmm. if I had to really boil it down to one thing, it's this: what holds a lot of people back is that, and this is going to sound a little crazy, right? But it's like, what got you, and I say you, me, any, like, anybody's listening here, what got you, and see if this applies to you, what got you to where you are today is actually going to be the very same thing that's going to hold you back from the next level that you want to get to. Mm. And I always sounds yeah. like, but I'm saying again, that what got you to where you are today is actually going to be the very thing holding you back from where you want to get to that next level. And so oftentimes what I would do is I work with people and I'm helping them sort of associate with how they got to where they are, but then also saying that is the very thing. So and it's like there's this paradox, if you will, right? There's these simple little mindset shifts that yeah. can create these extraordinary results. And oftentimes it's like we have one way of thinking and we power through, which gets us to where we are, but that same level of thinking is not going to get you to the next level. And then you yeah. have to create, but it's not these massive things. Like a lot of the people that are achieving at the highest level, there is just these little mindset shifts, you know? I don't know if that makes sense, right? And so I can give you an example, right? So an example might be this. All high achievers focus a lot on what they want, right? Like, this is what we want. This is the result I'm after. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I want. This is where I'm heading, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes if it's like holding a butterfly, you hold a butterfly too tight, right? And some, you know, you have a butterfly in your hands, and if you squeeze it and you squeeze it too tight, what happens, right? You squish it. It's like you've got to hold a butterfly in such a way where you don't hold it too softly where it flies away, but you don't hold it too tight where you kill it, right? And it's yeah. like sometimes we hold on to our goal so much that by thinking about it so much, you actually stop yourself from getting what you want, right? And so an example that I have is working here at Pepperdine, I'm so blessed to work with our team and with our coaching staff. And so there was a few years ago where we were doing really well. And we, you know, fortunately, we're one of the top teams in the country. And it's, you know, it's not an every year thing, but we find ourselves in the top 25. We've been in the top 10 and, you know, we've had some pretty good success. And, but again, we have to work for that. It's not a given. You have to work for that every single year. And, but there was a time where we're like, well, what's the next level for us? What's the next level? And how do we get to that level? Anyways, long story short is we made this shift. I kind of talked with our coaching staff and I talked with our players and took them through this process where I was like, well, you know, we need to redefine what we're doing everything for. And so I think a lot of programs, and again, I'm not going to necessarily just pigeonhole and say it's every program, but again, somebody's listening to this might be able to relate, but, you know, cutthroat industry, like a profession or NCAA Division One or just NCAAs, like a lot of teams, everything is centered around like the top of their pyramid is like, how do we win? How do we win? How do we get results? And every decision that you make is filtered through whatever is at the top of your pyramid. And so if winning is at the top of merit, that's going to drive every decision you make. So what we did is we said, well, is there a way for us to be able to still focus on winning, but not make it as important? So what we did is, you know, kind of give you a visual. It's like we took the pyramid and we just kind of took the concept of winning and we lowered it. And what we did is above it, we replaced this concept of developing women of character. We said, let's make developing women of character the most important piece of our program. Now, does that mean that we don't want to win? No, of course not. But what we're going to say is that winning is a byproduct or a process to help us achieve something way bigger than just a championship or, you know, a big win or whatever it's like that. So we replaced this concept. And so what did it do? It changed our entire process. It changed how we treat our players. It changed how we recruited. It changed our day-to-day interactions. It changed everybody that was associated with our program. And without, you know, because this guy could keep on and on and on, but the you know, Jace, here's the thing. When we focused less on winning with our program, that means we talked less about it. We didn't value it as much. The minute we did that, we've won more than we've ever won in our program.
Wow.
Like our program has gone to another level because what was holding us back was the very thing that's got us to where we are. What got us to where we are was let's, you know, what do we need to win? What do we need to get results? And the very thing that was holding us back is that we were focusing on results too much.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And so it's like, once we got out of our own way, everything changed. And, and it was simply a mindset shift and not a big one, but a small mindset shift to saying, okay, what do we value more than winning? Like, what are we really doing this for? And what we came up with is that our ultimate goal within our program, God has gifted us with the ability to take a group of young women and help them become the very best they can be. So our whole program is built around developing women of character. Yeah. And as I said, in the process, everything about our program is transformed, including our results, including what we've been able to achieve. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a crazy thing, you know? So that's what I would say, you know, and I can say that about a lot of different, not just soccer, not just teams, but individually in business and life. It's that concept that what got us to where we are today can actually be the very thing holding us back from what we want to get to.
Yeah. No, that you're right. It's not intuitive, but when you lay it out like that, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, from a training perspective, it makes sense too. I mean, whether you're training your, you know, your deadlift max or, you know, your mile, you know, endurance, you know, if I go out and I run 5 miles every day, I'm going to get, you know, whatever shape 5 miles a day gets me, but that's not going to take me to, you know, what shape 10 miles a day would. And it's not going to, same with deadlift. If I go and deadlift, you know, 225 pounds every day, once a day, that's not going to get me to a 300 pound deadlift, you know?
Totally.
And if you think of it like that, then it makes a lot of sense when you apply it to things like you're talking about, where your mindset, your mentality, your culture, and everything. So,
to connect the two, all I would say is for anybody listening, is like, be very conscious and very clear on what you want and why you want it. You know what I'm saying? Like, be very clear on what is it that you're working towards. You know what I'm saying? Like, because that will define everything, just like you said in your training. So, and I don't always think that everybody, I think a lot of people know what they don't want, but I don't think that everybody knows what they actually really want, you know? And so, that's interesting. Food for thought. goofed up.
Yeah. Yeah. We could go down a big rabbit hole there. All I say is you don't know what you want. Just try some things, but that's all I'm going to say. You could go on, and we're running out of time here. So I have some rapid fire questions for you. Answer these in 60 seconds or less, and then we'll wrap up here. So,
okay, cool.
When it comes to the aspect of recovery, whether it be mentally, physically, emotionally, what is one thing that you wish you could tell, you know, 17, 18 year old?
It would be connected to the emotion. Don't be so hard on yourself. Mm. Like a lot of times we are our own worst critics. And I just think we need to give ourselves some grace and some space to enjoy the journey more, right? And not focus on the destination. So it would literally be just don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So if you could be the best in the world in one sport that wasn't soccer or English football, what would that be?
Wow. I want to say, honestly, ice hockey. I have such an appreciation for what they do and the speed at which they do things on the ice, on skates. You know, I know there's something about, I'm not a massive fan of the NHL, but I just really appreciate whenever I watch a match, I am super, super enthralled by what they do. So, NHL.
Cool. And then if you were to gauge an athlete's likelihood to succeed based on three qualities or three habits without knowing the sport, without knowing the athletic body, without even seeing the athlete, like what three qualities would you bet on?
Number one, durability. I think a lot of the best athletes, they're durable physically, durable mentally, and able to overcome a lot of things. Some of the stuff that we've talked about, being durable, being able to maintain and continue, and not get dragged down or bogged down. So durability, I think right along that has to be adaptability. I think they go hand in hand. So adaptability, being able to adapt, knowing that life isn't always going to go your way or things aren't always going to go your way. And how do you adapt? How do you adapt to change? How do you adapt through adversity? So adaptability. So durability, adaptability. And I think third would be urgency. I think that the people that I know that are doing life at a high level, there is a sense of urgency in that they want to get things done and they want to make it happen. And I know we're kind of strapped on time, but I look like this, Jason. It's almost like they have a way to compress time. Like a lot of times, I don't think we always do things in the present because we don't realize what's going to happen because of it. And so therefore we let things go and we'll get to it another day. But then the greats have a way to compress time. They know that what they're doing now in the present moment, they have a clear picture of like how it's going to affect me in 6 months or a year or 5 years or 10 years. And they bring the future into the present and they compress it in such a way where things become way more urgent. You know what I'm saying? And you could look at that from a recovery standpoint. Like if you knew that in 5 years, you could add at the end of your career, you could add 5 years to your career. If you just recovered correctly, then you would be way more urgent in the way that you recover. If you knew that when you got to, you know, 35, you knew that you could actually go till 40, you know, or 45, all you got to do is do things right in the present moment. So urgency, I think, is a big thing. So durability, adaptability, and urgency.
Awesome. Well, I don't think we could have ended on a more powerful note there. So if you're listening and you want to connect with Max, I'll tell you that in a second here, but Max does speaking. He does coaching for both athletes and coaches, if I'm not mistaken there. MaxRook.com is a great place to connect with him. And Rook is spelled ROOKE.com and then Max with X. And then Instagram, he's at Max J Rook, Twitter, Max_Rook. And then on Facebook, you can find him at Life2, the Max on Facebook. Anywhere else or anything you want to say on
that? That's it. I'm happy to answer any questions. If anybody has a need, wants to reach out. I love connecting with people. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And he does have some pretty good resources too for some self-discovery on his website. So be sure to check that out. I'll have links to it in the show notes. So thanks so much for being on the show, Max.
Jace, you're amazing. I just want to let you know you're doing amazing things. I really appreciate the time you spent today. But yeah, you're doing so much great work and adding so much value to people. So keep it up yourself. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Max.
All right.
All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jace, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.